Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
The Vatican Museums reopen the Room of Mysteries in the Borgia Apartments after a lengthy restoration. We take a tour and look at who was the Spanish Pope who chose one of Renaissance Italy's finest painters to decorate his secret rooms. Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining us for this very special edition. They were once known as the secret rooms of the Pope, but they're also called the Borgia Apartments up in the Vatican Museums, one floor beneath Raphael's famous stanzas. The apartments are comprised of five rooms with brilliantly colored wall paintings by the Renaissance Italian artist Pinturicchio and his workshop. They depict scenes from the Bible and allegory. The apartments get their name from the Pope who commissioned their decoration, Alexander VI, whose family name, Borgia, gives us a glimpse of his Spanish roots and his unique role in history.
He was born Rodrigo Borgia in January 1431 near Valencia, Spain. When his uncle, Cardinal Alfonso Borgia, was elected Pope Calixtus II, the ambitious Rodrigo was 24 years old. The new pope took his nephew under his wing, sending him to study law in Bologna, and then making him cardinal deacon of a Roman church, setting him squarely on the road to a career in the church hierarchy. The young cardinal was entrusted with managing the papal chancery, a powerful position in the curia, and though many envied his lucrative job, he was considered a careful administrator. He was known for his imposing but cheerful figure, brilliant conversation, and love of card playing. But he was also known to have committed a few indiscretions, which provoked the scathing reproof of Pope Pius II. Yet he enjoyed the admiration of many, so much so that he was elected to the papacy himself in the conclave of 1492. He took the name of Pope Alexander VI. As Pope, he set about eliminating lawlessness in Rome and improving the city's security defenses. He also fostered the arts, literature, and sciences, and consolidated the temporal power of the papacy.
It was 1492. Spain was becoming a superpower.
Professor Arnold Nesselrath is the chief curator of the Vatican Museums, responsible for the restoration of the Borgia apartments now underway. As soon as he was elected, Pope Alexander VI commissioned Pinturicchio to decorate his new papal apartments. It was 1492, in Renaissance Italy, and as that name belies, a period of rebirth and renewal.
The Spaniards had just conquered Granada, which was the last bastion of the Moors in Spain. So the Spanish king, only 4 years later, already under Alexander VI, became the so-called Catholic king. That's a title he got at the time, which is the Spanish king is keeping till the present day. And then only a few months after his election, Columbus went again from Spain to the New World. He discovered America.
It was a profoundly worldly period, a very political period, an extremely intelligent period.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture for Duquesne University's Rome campus.
There's a whole class of men who were great scholars who were finding all these Greek texts, these Latin texts, translating them, speculating on them, writing about them. The new world was being discovered, and a new world every day from that moment on. So there was this expanding of horizons so that people felt that the world was getting larger and larger. And at the same time, there was this very sophisticated art, music, literature that was again piling on. So it was an extremely worldly period where man was celebrated as man. It was a very humanistic period.
And it was in this period that Alexander had become one of the key players in a political game of chess.
Alexander VI Borgia's papacy was very strongly supported by Isabel and Ferdinand of Spain, who of course are the same people who are funding Columbus's expedition to the New World. With this opening up of the New World, there are contracts and monopolies and rights and properties which need to be validated by the papacy. So many people in Rome, people in France, they were very concerned about Spanish sovereigns who seemed to be getting a monopoly on the New World. And on top of that, the man who would ratify all this happens to be their creature in the papal seat. And so Alexander VI comes into the papacy at a disadvantage because he's Spanish, because he's a foreigner, because it's only 100 years since the papacy moved back from Avignon when they had been under the wing of another foreign monarch. And people are very concerned about whether or not this closeness between the Spanish monarchs and the papacy is going to end up affecting Rome, if the papacy will even leave. And so a lot of the lore around Alexander VI is colored by these very important political factors.
But Alexander VI was not the kind of man to give up in the face of difficulty or opposition.
He was a very powerful person. He was basically second in command after his predecessor, Innocent VIII, as the vice chancellor. He had quite a number of children from sort of his previous life, and he brought this family with him to the Vatican and relied on his family members. This was something which was quite normal since medieval times. Today it's known under the name of nepotism, but it was a way of getting people one could trust into the most important positions in the Curia.
But if nepotism was considered normal back in the 15th century, how normal was it for a pope to have children? And how should we Catholics look back on such papacies?
There was, throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, the possibility of becoming a cardinal as a layperson without going through the process of being ordained. And out of these sort of raucous, youthful adventures, some popes end up with children. I mean, they become cardinals already with children, or as cardinals who are not priests, they have children, which is already a sin against chastity, but somehow it doesn't seem to add that sense of sacrilege, which horrifies a lot of us. Then there are popes who remain very sensual men even after they become pope, and I'm afraid Alexander VI appears to have completely fallen in that category. At which point we have to do what people in the Renaissance did, which is to separate a bit the man from the position, and that realizing that the people who applied to Alexander VI for indulgences to get their grandparents out of purgatory, to be forgiven for sins, those people's indulgences, those people's forgiveness, no matter what Alexander VI does, it was real. It was theirs. We just try not to follow his example as a man. I think it just makes us all very grateful in the 21st century, in the 20th century, that we haven't had to deal with papacies like this.
Though he may be remembered by some for his failings, Alexander VI was a man of profound faith.
There is a very deep spiritual aspect to Alexander VI that comes out in tiny little glimmers, whether it be the rumored donation of the first gold from the New World for Santa Maria Maggiore, his profound devotion to the Blessed Virgin, the prayer for the opening of the holy doors, and again, the strange iconography of his apartments.
There are three big staterooms. Then there are two rooms in the Borgia Tower, which are probably already more secret, i.e. more private. And then there are the secret rooms where the Pope would sleep, where he had his bathroom, which were not accessible to visitors. And they were really, they were the real secret rooms, i.e. the real private rooms.
And those are available for public view, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, people go through, they see the ceiling and they see modern paintings underneath. They don't recognize that they're passing through the Pope's bathroom with grotesque decoration on the walls. All of this is something they don't see nowadays because these rooms have been transformed into museum rooms. And the original function is unfortunately lost to a great extent, which is, of course, affecting our understanding of these rooms.
To understand the Borgia apartments and Alexander VI himself, one needs to look at the iconography, the subjects the Pope chose in decorating his private apartments. But was his choice strange, as Professor Lev earlier remarked?
It's an iconography which is very spiritual, given the fact that we're dealing with rooms that herald the approach of both the temporal and spiritual sovereign. And as you move through these Borgia apartments, as you move from one room to the next, you're getting closer and closer to the inner sanctum, where you meet the Pope, who is not only the spiritual head of the Church, but he's the king of central Italy. And we're presented with such an Alexander VI Borgia, who's so lost in his temporal reality. And yet when we look at the apartments present a very spiritual vein, a sort of detachment from worldly things as you move closer and closer to the person of the Pope.
The person of the Pope is an actual portrait of Alexander Borgia found in the room of the Mysteries of the Faith, recently returned after meticulous restoration to all its colorful splendor. While it took Pinturicchio and his team just 2 years to paint all five rooms, it took 4 years to restore just this one room. Professor Nesselrath gave me a tour of this, the first room in the Borgia apartments.
We have a fresco cycle made of seven scenes in this room, which are the joys of the Virgin Mary. It starts off in the first scene with the Annunciation, the Archangel Gabriel coming in, greeting the Virgin, and God the Father at the top. Then next to it is the Nativity scene. The Virgin Mary and Joseph are looking down at the Christ child with a wonderful Umbrian landscape in the background. The next scene is the Adoration of the Magi, a very full scene, many figures, many colors, very rich and exuberant in every sense of the word.
You have these remarkable juxtapositions where when you enter the room and you look straight to the back of the room, you have the Annunciation and you have the Nativity side by side. The Annunciation in a very structured, architectural, Roman, elaborately built environment. And then the Nativity, so simple and so humble in a way that is a sort of unusual strain in art. The child, the baby Jesus, lying bare on the grass, on the ground. Instead of exalted high up in his mother's or protected by his mother's arms, he lies humble, nude, on the grass with all the figures converging downwards. So the grandeur of antiquity that's represented in the Annunciation and the humility of the Nativity in the next painting. So yes, there's a tremendous amount of allowing oneself to contemplate mystery in these images.
Then the principal fresco, the Resurrection of Christ, the only fresco where Mary is not represented, where the Pope himself is witnessing what is happening here, a fresco by a very young artist who tried out various effects, various poses.
An interesting one is the fellow behind. behind the tomb who's looking up.
Looking up, and you can look into his nose. So he's obviously a young chap who wants to show the master what he's capable of doing.
Would one artist have been responsible for each of these lunettes, or a number of artists?
Well, one artist would have designed the lunette, and it's unlikely that all lunettes have been designed by Pinturicchio, because they're not very coordinated. The proportions of the figures are different, the colors, the vestments of the figures are different. So it looks as if each artist was given the task to design such a scene, and when it was approved by Pinturicchio, by the Pope, then these artists were put together, a handful of people who would go up and paint these scenes.
This portrait of Alexander, though, would have been by Pinturicchio himself?
It is a very strong portrait, and traditionally one tends to think that the master was always the best artist in the group, which is not necessarily so. But because of the quality of the portrait, it's traditionally attributed to Pinturicchio. It's clearly different from the rest of the fresco, so there the young artist at least had to accept someone interfering with what he was doing. Perhaps the most enchanting detail is a self-portrait of a young artist on the cuirass of one of the soldiers in front of the tomb of Christ in the resurrection scene. The cuirass, of course, is made of metal. It reflects.
It's a breastplate, basically.
It's a breastplate. So the artist showed himself while painting this.
Which, of course, is something you cannot see from our viewpoint down here looking up.
It was a reminiscence. He left, and he did not count on anybody come across this. But, of course, he would always remember to be present in his self-portrait when the Pope was using this room, holding a private audience. He would always watch from above what the Pope was doing down there, even if it was only in his own image.
Well, of course, he also chose the very lunette where the portrait of Alexander VI was present.
He was very lucky to get that scene, but yes, he would see the visitor first when he came in, because, again, he could look down from this breastplate much better than the Pope could from praying in front of the tomb, and he was really in a key position in the room.
Do you think the Pope would have known that a little old artist had done that?
I don't think so, and he was quite a young, cheeky person who did this, and these are the jokes these spirited minds very often leave in works of art, which give a very lively impression also what happened on these working sites.
The resurrection scene would have been the first thing Pope Alexander Borgia's guests would have seen upon entering his papal apartments, but that's not how visitors enter it today.
The way we approach it logistically from the museums, we enter through the throne room into the anteroom, which is not how it works when you're walking through papal apartments. Originally, you would have come from the other side, through the very large Hall of the Popes, which was the big reception room. And from the Hall of the Popes, you would have moved into the room or the Hall of the Mysteries, which was a smaller anteroom. And from there, you would have been brought to the nucleus, to the core of the palace, which is where you would have been in the presence of the Pope. And yet, when you walk in from the Hall of the Popes and you look immediately to your left at the wall, there's beautiful trompe-l'oeil cabinets, these amazing little trompe-l'oeil perspective. Looks like they're little cabinets on the wall. And what's sitting in that cabinet but the papal tiara and the pallium? As if the Pope himself, when he comes out of the Hall of the Popes and he goes towards the Hall of the Mysteries of our salvation, he goes towards the saints, he takes off his heavy burden of temporal power, he removes that burden of his shoulders, and he opens himself up to the spiritual. And then you look up, and there he is, bareheaded, kneeling before Christ. And it presents a completely different Alexander VI than the one that we hear about all the time.
It also creates a unity in that apartment, doesn't it? You walk in, the trompe-l'oeil of the tiara is right there on your left-hand side on the wall in a fake niche.
Mm-hmm.
And there you are looking at Alexander on the other side.
Oh, there's a tremendous amount of unity in the room, from the ceilings all the way down. I mean, the ceilings are decorated with these prophets, and each of the prophets bears a banner with the pronouncement which exactly foretells the event or the mystery in the vault or in the lunette down below.
Over the window here, looking out over the courtyard, we have another larger, would you call this a lunette as well?
This is a lunette as well, but of course the window is cutting in, and they've chosen here the ascension of Christ, and because of the unfortunate space, they put the two angels at the top next to the mandorla.
And then over here, over the entrance door.
Over the entrance door is the coming of the Holy Spirit, the fresco of Pentecost, with the Virgin Mary in the center and the 12 apostles around her. However, it's painted in the landscape, and it's not illustrated in the traditional iconography as it is described in the Bible. The last lunette is an Assumption of the Virgin Mary, again with two witnesses down near her tomb. The one is St. Thomas with the belt of the Virgin, which he found in the tomb, and the other one is a contemporary portrait of a member of the Borgia family, probably. The Virgin is also crowned by two angels. This is an important element also in the prayers about the seven joys of the Virgin Mary. Usually the coronation of the Virgin is performed by her son Jesus, but here it's put into the fresco to somehow conform to this tradition of these seven prayers.
Now here, especially, you can note on the robes of many of the apostles, big areas where the paint is missing, where there's gray plaster showing through. Now that was a restoration choice, a decision to leave those areas without paint?
There are many areas in these frescoes where the technique Pinturicchio has chosen caused a very poor state of preservation. And sometimes what is missing are entire faces, are whole hands, and there is no way we can know how these things looked before. And then we have to respect the personal style of each of the artists involved, and therefore one does not fill these areas in with real color. One just tries to tone them down so they don't disturb the eye, and only if you look at the things very carefully for a very long time you begin to notice them, and the eye itself can reconstruct, can fill in these areas. And this is done in the human mind, and you don't know to impose something on the visitor. That's why we leave this and we try to avoid fragmentary view of the frescoes. We try to stimulate the imagination of a unique, of an integral impression of the fresco. And this is a philosophy we follow. We don't renovate these frescoes, we don't repaint anything. We give the impression of what we have. Like a human face gets old, gets wrinkles, these frescoes are not presented as if there was something new, and this is never the goal of our restorations.
The modern line of restoration, the theory of restoration, doesn't allow to reconstruct something. Just a small little rigatino, we call rigatino. It means a sort of reconstruction, optics reconstruction, made by line by line, but not using the original painting, but a watercolor painting.
The Vatican Museum's chief restorer, Maurizio De Luca, and his team have been painstakingly removing layer upon layer of dirt and grit, which have dulled Pinturicchio's masterpieces over the last few hundred years. He says that before his team could apply any paintbrush or cotton ball, an in-depth scientific analysis had to be carried out on the paint and the materials Pinturicchio used. Electronic microscopes examined the infinitely thin layers of plaster and paint employed, while other chemical exams were conducted to determine the exact composition of every color used. But instead of finding wall frescoes, the traditional method of decoration for the period, De Luca's restorers discovered Pinturicchio had used simple tempera, water-based paint, in the decoration of the Borgia apartments.
Yes, exactly, tempera. Tempera made by oil, glue, wax sometimes, or eggs.
From eggs as yes, well, the yolk and the albumen from
yes,
the eggs.
Yes, yes. And this technique is very delicate. And the difficulty of restoration was to clean the surface painting, carrying out the solvent that we use doesn't penetrate the plaster.
Oh, I see.
Because the humidity and water and the scientific research allowed us to use a correct solvent. It's a sort of investigation of composition of the colors of the mortar and the plaster and so on.
Pinturicchio must have chosen tempera over the more common fresco technique to get the job done quickly. Pope Alexander was an impatient client. But tempera meant the paintings were less likely to survive the tests of time and climate. So how long will this restoration last?
Depends on the humidity and the environment of the conservation. Doesn't depend from the technique, the colors, but just from the conservation, the site, the room and the windows.
It took Pinturicchio and his bottega 2 years to
yes.
paint these
yes,
rooms,
yes,
but
years.
It took you 4 years to
yes,
to
yes,
restore them.
Yes, yes, I don't know how many painters was here at that time.
How many restorers did
restorers,
you have?
Five restorers for the up level and others five restorers for the low register.
But that's a long time.
A long time, yes. But the difficulty of a restoration carried out many times, many times. You know. First of all, in order to individuate the exact method of cleaning, restoration is made by the hands of a restorer. Chemistry and technology help us.
And I met some of the young restorers here from the Vatican Laboratories who were so proud of what they did.
yes. I hope so. I just an old restorer, but they are very young. Yeah.
This meticulous cleaning brings out a Pinturicchio, a color, a look we haven't seen before. And I think applying that kind of revelation to looking at the man who commissioned it with a sort of fresher look, and looking at this painter who's been so maligned throughout history, his best work in the Piccolomini Library in Siena, well, it was just done to cartoons by Raphael, without seeing him in his own right as a man who studied antiquity and learned the techniques and learned the designs, and a man who was able to really bring to life a series of paintings that help you meditate on mystery. And there's something a little magical about those paintings, which helps you get into the mind of a hall of mysteries.
Professor Elizabeth Lev of Duquesne University. You also heard Maurizio De Luca, chief restorer, and Vatican Museum's curator, Professor Arnold Nesselrath. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Laudator Jesus Christus.